Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. From our workshops in Juneau, Alaska and London, England, we get together on the Echolink system to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
KL7R, KL7R, M0HBR. Are you there, Mike?
Yeah, M0HBR, KL7R. Morning, Bill. How are you doing this morning?
Yeah, real good. It's the 2nd of December. And let's see, 0644 Greenwich Mean Time here in London. So good morning from London. Good evening to you. And what's up there on the slopes of the Mendenhall Glacier?
We're having a record snowfall here in Juneau. We've got 4 feet on the ground. I went and put up Christmas lights last night with my wife, and I stepped off the porch and walked to the end of the house, and the snow was, you know, up to my waist. So I have short legs, but that's still, in the 3.5 to 4 foot range there. It's a lot of snow on the ground, and we're getting a bunch coming down now. It looks like you're going to get another 20 inches, and then turn to rain. So hopefully it won't bend my roof there. I have a wood roof, but you hate to see the things creaking up there. So I might have to shovel the roof. Go ahead.
Oh man. Well, I guess that goes with the territory, Mike. It sounds like you're going to have a white Christmas for sure up there. We, of course, will not be. I guess it's the temperature here. Fahrenheit, Yahoo told me this morning it's about 45 degrees out, and looks overcast. But, well, I understand that you have been melting some solder, both in the real world and the virtual world and in the experimental methods world. So why don't you tell us about that? As you speak, I'm going to step over to the bookshelf and pull out my copy of EM RFD KL7R M0HPR.
Well, I've been looking at on page 2.20 of chapter 2 of experimental methods. There's a figure 2.57 feedback amplifier, and that thing is a pretty cool little amp. I was looking at it in Spice, and it shows a 20 dB flat gain through HF and up, depending on your transistor, and it seems fairly insensitive to moderate variations in resistors and capacitors in it. The capacitor, the thing that has the most effect as far as capacitors is going, is the little feedback capacitor between the collector and base bias resistor. That thing, if I dropped it down to 0.01, I saw a moderate change in gain. But it seems pretty insensitive to transistors and components, and it's just an amazing little amp. I went ahead and built one, using a 2N2222 and parts I had in my a bunch of resistors. I have resistors, but then I have packets of too much of some. So I use not exactly the same values, and I got an amp that was fairly flat at 18 dB of gain and about 100 milliwatts out, and it's a beautiful thing there, Bill. Go ahead.
Okay, I just want to make sure I'm on the right page. I'm looking at figure 2.57 on page 2.20. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, that's a real, yeah, it's a nice one. It's got the two kinds of feedback in there. And, yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. And it must have been really neat to build it in LT Spice and then to build it on the workbench. So you've got the three. You've got from the pages of the MRFD on the screen of LT Spice, and then actually generating solder smoke on the workbench of the KL7R. Yeah, when I've been doing similar things, for a while we were talking about my little Class A amplifier without feedback and without emitter degeneration, and it's a good thing to go through because you come to understand why the feedback networks are so useful and important. You know, in fixing the gain. You know, when you start thinking about amplifiers, you start thinking, wow, yeah, as much gain as possible. That's what you want. But of course, you don't. You want to be able to control it because you're trying to get. Very often, you're putting the amplifier between at a point in the schematic where you've got a certain amount of power coming from the previous stage. You don't want to overdo it. You don't want to underdo it. You just need the right amount. And the feedback, of course, helps you set the stage gain. And then the effects on the impedances are dramatic too. It allows you to set that up quite nicely. For a while, I had a tough time just sort of conceptually understanding how the feedback networks, the two different ones there, affected the impedances. I didn't have too much trouble understanding why the emitter resistor increased input impedance. That seemed pretty intuitive. If you put something there in the line, it's gonna increase the impedance. But I didn't really understand why the collector to base network that they put in there had the opposite effect. But I've eventually come to understand it. I hope you don't ask me to explain it right now because I'm still on my first cup of coffee. But anyway, well, that's cool. And well, tell us, Mike, what have you learned from Figure 2.57 in experimental methods for RF design, KL7R, M0HBR?
Well, that I don't know much. That's a good start. That it's fun playing a video game with LT Spice, diddling values of circuits. You know, you want to go for max gain, so you drop emitter to resistor to nothing, and well, that was too much. And then and then you try decade sweeps. If you go to the simulate in LT Spice and edit simulation command. Normally I was doing transient sweeps, showing a few cycles of I'd say 7 megahertz and then seeing if it was clipping. But you can also do an AC analysis and a decade sweep, and you can plot dB gain in LT Spice. And so I've been doing that some, it's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting to fiddle with even lower value emitter generation resistance and see how that. I don't want to go there. See how that affects input SWR and there are ways of doing that in Spice that I've seen. But I'm not ready to talk about or competent to talk about. But it's possible to wire up simple circuits to these test things to get input resistance or like we were talking, you can use I haven't got to it yet, but you can use a return loss bridge to measure input resistance, input impedance, input SWR. Input return loss for you can measure that, and apparently there's a way to do output return loss also, or output impedance, and that's where I'm going next. I just wanted to get this amp built. I wanted to just look at it and see what it acted like, and it acts very much like LT Spice. There is an interaction between the emitter degeneration resistor and the collector base feedback collector capacitor and resistor in that they kind of work against each other and with each other, and they set gain and they set input impedance and output impedance. So it's kind of weird. I don't fully understand the other than the fact that it's a 4-to-1 transformer. I don't understand the effect of that transformer. You know, other than maybe it's just a 4-to-1 transformer. I've seen other circuits that didn't have it in there. And I'm starting to learn stuff, but basically it's a video game. Play the video game, see what happens, and then build it and see if it's real. Bill, or go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's the fun and educational part. The transformer is just to take the 50 ohm load and convert it. I guess I'm eyeballing it. It looks like it's converting it up to 200 ohms, which is a pretty common load, I think, for this kind of amp. And that's important because it's going to affect in many ways determine the power out of the amplifier, the load that's actually presented to the transistor. So that's what that's for. Yeah, and you're right about the feedback networks, and you know, and their effect, and how they do work with each other. Hey, I had a similar experience, not nearly as meaningful and interesting as yours, but I went to work one day this week with the new issue of QST tucked into my briefcase, and in it there's Rick Campbell's article on an SSB transmitter, and I was reading through it. His articles are always really interesting, and I like the receiver article that he ran, where especially because he made frequent reference to the Drake 2B receiver. But on this transmitter article, I didn't have a long bus ride, so I couldn't get through the whole article. But given that we're talking a lot about amplifiers and struggling with them a lot, I went right to the final, and it was fun for me because having gone through all this that we're going through with LT Spice and with experimental methods, I was able to look at Rick's final and look at the biasing network on the base, kind of just eyeball how much voltage in bias he was putting on the base, then just jump across to the emitter, you know, and figure 0.6 or 0.7 volts drop there, and determine, just kind of eyeballing again on the little red London double decker bus, eyeball the voltage across the emitter resistor, and then just kind of back of the envelope figure, okay, how much idle current is he running through this thing? And I couldn't have done that. I couldn't even have come close to doing that, I guess, a year or so ago. So all this yakking here on solder smoke has done some good, Mike. KL7R M0HBR.
Yeah. Well, cool. And I probably still couldn't do it. So, but I'm learning something. Something is sticking. I think it's doing some good. I'm that trick of trying to actually build a transceiver earlier. That thing was a real education in how much I didn't know. So you know, going back to basics and getting some mentoring and you're helping, and it's good stuff. On the schematic here. There is a resistor, a 43 ohm resistor that goes between the 12 volts and then it's shunted with a capacitor to ground. And Jeff Dam was mentioning that was part of my problems with on the back of his paper plate. That was part of my problems with all the instability I had in my amplifier chain. In that I was running bypass capacitors, but I didn't have any, the only R was the R resistance of the wire between the bypass capacitor and the power supply. So they're adding a little bit of resistance here to get more of an RC low-pass filter than you can get with a low-resistance wire going to the 12 volts. Anyway, enough of that. What you been up to there, Bill? Go ahead.
Hey, well, Mike, you just set off a little light bulb in my head there. I've always been wondering about the reasoning behind that resistor that they put in from the 12 volt line, and the way you put it there, and just explaining the RC with the bypass and making it more of a low pass filter. Well, thanks to you, and thanks to Jeff Dam for for enlightening me here this morning. That's great. Yeah. Okay. Well, more on this. Let's talk about this circuit some more. Maybe in the next episode, and I'm going to try to get my thoughts together and try to remember how I understood the effect of the collector to base feedback network. Again, I did come to understand it. And I jotted it down in my notebook, but it's too early in the morning. But yeah, I wanted to mention another project on the. A repair project. I told you guys about the power supply that I picked up at the Kempton Park Hamfest, and I put a picture of it up on the Gadgeteer News webpage. And it's a nice looking thing. It's got a great heavy box, and it's got 24 volts unregulated DC out across one set of terminals, and it's got 15 volts, up to 15 volts, regulated and adjustable across other terminals. And I took it, and it's got a little voltmeter on the front panel, and I picked it up at the Hamfest and jiggled it and saw the meter moving, an important trick. At least the meter was not dead. So I paid the 5 pounds or whatever it was, and I took the thing home. And when I fired it up, I looked at the output on the scope, and it was not DC. And I figured, oh, man, there's something wrong in there. My first suspicion was that the electrolytics had dried up or gone bad or shorted or something. Those are the likely suspects in this case. And I opened it up, and I looked in there, and there's these two big electrolytics in there, and I figured, okay, I'm going to have to start rummaging around and finding something suitable to replace them. And then just as I was kind of moving the electrolytic to try to look for what value they had in there, I noticed that one of the leads from the electrolytic to the circuit board had a bad soldering joint, and a bad mechanical connection had combined to have the wire just sitting there floating in the air. So out came the soldering gun, and just a little bit of heating and application of solder, and the thing was working, and now it's producing DC, and this is providing an incentive for me to build an amplifier that uses a 24 volts on the collector or the drain, KL7RM 0HBR.
All right, Bill. We'll build an FET amp, and then you see a lot of them that have 24 volt or 28 volt, and what did I see? I think in the handbook, there was a deal about a push-pull IRF 510 amp using 28 volts. It was getting something like 40 watts out or something. That might be real fun to try to do something like that. Cool. Well, I had a similar experience. Remember I told you I was blowing up all kind of stuff here in the shack? I was blowing up, I blew up that 74-240 amplifier for QRSS, and I blew up my, I don't know if that's what did it, but anyway, I was blowing up stuff like crazy, and I told you I saw some hash in the output of my QRSS amplifier, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. I thought I was getting some sort of motorboating in the power supply. So anyway, after blowing it up and sitting it aside for a week or two, I started again with this little amp, and then I noticed it had some terrible looking output. I said, "What is going on with this amp?" And so then I put the scope on the power supply, and I'm square waving at 0 to 20 volts. And it turns out the power supply is pulse width modulated at 0 to 20 volts pulse width modulated. And I had neglected. I said, well, I have clean DC. Why do I need this here 100 microfarad capacitor on the output? What possibly good could that do? I've already got nice DC out of my source supply, and I guess it's to stop it from seeing the pulse width modulated. Well, KD1JV said it was for power supply stability, but anyway, when I put it in there, it was clean power and didn't make all that weirdness. And that explained a whole bunch of stuff there. Bill, go ahead.
The net comes to the rescue. How did we ever build things without being able to resort to questions to QRPL and the web and Usenet groups? Well, I know we built things and they didn't work, and then you just got frustrated and threw it off in the corner, and that was the end of it. I had several projects like that in pre-internet days, but we got a lot more resources now. Hey, I want to go back to figure 2.57, if we could, Mike. I have just remembered how I came to understand the effect of the collector-to-base feedback network on input impedance. And here's what the books always point out, that by installing this network, this kind of feedback from collector-to-base has the effect of increasing input oh man, I'm all goofed up. Let me think about it some more. KL7RM0HBR.
All right. Well, it wasn't fair. You know, it's not quite daylight where you're at. Well, it's 7 a.m. It must be getting there. So it's not fair to play on you, though. On that, I put that schematic up on my web page under Spice. There's a tab on the left on my website there, and I put it up there under the Spice model. So if you've got LT Spice, you can just click on it, and it'll open up that schematic, and then you can take a look at it. Also on LT Spice, remember I told you about that SM0 VPO. Half-watt amp. It's basically a push-pull paralleled 2N2222s. So there's four 2N2222s. Two of them are paralleled, and another two are paralleled, and those four are push-pull, and they're driven with one driver amp, 2N2222. So five 2N2222s, and it's a half a watt. It's a really cool-looking amp, and you know, you look on his website, and it looks so wonderful according to his specs. And I saw it had peaky behavior when I built it, and you know, it peaked around 7 megahertz. So I built this thing in LT Spice, and sure enough, it peaked right at 7 megahertz. So I really want to add some feedback to that driver transistor in LT Spice, and then see if I can recreate it in the real thing, and maybe I'll give Harry my changes there, but well, did any of that come back to you, Bill, during that transmission? M0HBR, KL7R.
No, none of it's coming back to me. This will have to wait for Solder Smoke 43, and it's still dark here, by the way, so I have an excuse. And it's been a long week. No, this is a blatant effort on my part to change the subject, because it's terribly embarrassing that I can't figure out how the feedback network works. But I want to introduce a new segment to Solder Smoke, and I think we can call it, hold on, stand by, Name That Noise. And here in the Name That Noise segment, we're going to ask our listeners to identify some weird bit of noise coming in on the amateur radio frequencies. I'm a big fan of 17 meters, and ever since I've been in London, there's been this really nasty noise appearing at about 18.115 megahertz. And I think it's very local. I've asked other guys to listen for it who are not that far away, and they can't hear it. But I can hear it, and it's here all the time. It's here whether the band's open or whether the band's closed. Again, making me think that it's quite local. And what I want to do is just turn it on here. There it is. There's that beast. And I'm going to tune through it, and hopefully some of our digital and RFI savvy listeners will be able to tell me what this thing is. Here it is. Now I'm going to tune down through it. There it's gone. Now I'm going to tune up through it. Covers about 10 kc there, and quite annoying because it's in a part of the band where some of the nicest people on 17 meters hang out. SM0OWX is down in that area, and every time I hear Chris calling, it's through that junk. So, Mike, you are in a privileged position here, being being one of the solder smokers. So, you get the first shot at it. Mike, a KL7R, name that noise.
It's a computer. It's a clock. I haven't heard that sound or things like it for some time. But back in the days of TRS-80 computers, they used to put out tons of awful hash like that. So you might look around for things that have clocks in them. Things like computers and you know, clocks. There's something that's got a clock and a time base. Like, you know, it doesn't sound like a television time base, but something with a time base is doing it there, Bill.
All right. Well, that's okay. Well, we've got, that's more information than I had before. And for those who have seen the Google Earth photo of my location, you can realize how many computers I probably have in real close proximity. I'm sitting here right now looking at the wall, and I bet you that if I went 10 feet to my right, I'd have to go through the wall, and I'd be in the apartment, the block of flats of the apartment house next door. So there could be another computer sitting right on the other side of that wall, which would be, just estimating, maybe 8 feet from 8 feet from my Drake 2B receiver. Welcome to densely populated London, KL7R, M0HPR.
Yeah, Bill, KL7R back. You know, I got a lot of mileage out of reading what was it, the RFI handbook or something? But the main thing I did that was helpful is I got a little AM broadcast portable radio and went DFing around my house, and I found a couple of bad things in my house, and I found my neighbor has a bad thing. But you might hitch up your little receiver there to a battery and a small antenna, and just go DFing and find out where it's coming from. That might be pretty productive there.
And I think I'm going to live with this one. Just accept it. There, it was more just kind of curiosity to kind of figure out what it is. But no, I think we're just going to work around it. I'll just use my transmitter on 17 is crystal controlled with a VXO. So I'll just use the crystal that's higher up on the band and just live with it. You know, the trick you mentioned about DFing the RFI, when I was in the Azores, there was I knew it had to be part of the streetlight system, because as soon as the sun went down and the light sensors turned on the street lights, I'd get this really bad kind of AC junk coming across all the amateur frequencies, and something was obviously arcing in there, arcing really bad and generating a lot of RF. And I thought about taking my little radio, just like you described, and walking around the neighborhood and checking for which light bulb or which power pole is creating this junk. But I had a problem because I was my job in the Azores. I was the American consul, and people were already, because when they saw the antennas that were gradually spouting up on my house or growing up on the roof, I think they already started to think the consul might be a bit nuts. And if I started walking around the neighborhood holding a radio, listening to the telephone poles, that would definitely reinforce those suspicions, Mike. So there again in the Azores, I decided to just live with it. KL7R, M0HPR.
In the interest of diplomacy, I'm not going to walk around my neighborhood with a Yagi pointing at all the power lines. Well, I did. I got so bad here that I had a little arrow antenna or something. No, I think it was an antenna I built for 2 meters or something. And it was an antenna I built for 2 meters. And I went DFing around. And you know, I'm walking past my neighbor's house, and I'm trying to be really subtle. I point the antenna right in his living room, and then I walk another 50 feet, and I point it at his living room from another angle. You know, I'm being pretty subtle. Well, I think the way to solve your RFI problem, Bill, is to get access to the power switch panel in your building and just start shutting off neighbors till the power goes away, and that should help you locate the source of the problem there, M0HBR. KL7R.
Perfect. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, they'll love that. Maybe I'll just it's actually we're in a house, and it's a apartment building immediately adjacent, and I just turn out the whole building. Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, you gotta watch these things. I think we'll just live with it. Let's see. He's talking about weird noises. I got another email this morning from Brian KG4ENB, who sent a WAV file with some weird sounds of his own. And I might, when we do the editing on this, do an experiment and see if I can put it in and let people listen to it. So it might show up there. But I don't know. It sounded sort of like, it was a really weird digital signal, and it sounded like kind of a babbling brook. That's the best way I can describe it. And I noticed that in the current issue of QST, Steve Ford, in his really excellent eclectic technology column, I think that's what the title is, but it's about different bits of technology related to ham radio, he points out that there's a website out there that will assist people in identifying Not so much RFI, but the different digital modes that are in operation. And Steve points out that the staffers at ARRL headquarters frequently get questions like we've been discussing this morning, like what is that sound? And he said that they've gotten pretty good at identifying by ear the different digital modes. So Brian, I'm gonna work on your sound here a little bit and see if we can figure it out. But anyway, this has been fun. Send us your strange electromagnetic noises, and we'll see if we can identify them here on Solder Smoke. Let's see, what else can we talk about, Mike? You and I have been talking about videos, and I've been updating the video page on my website, and you sent me this morning a really cool video. This is the another piece of video from the fellow up in Quebec who is flying the radio controlled airplane with the kind of virtual reality goggles linked by video to the onboard camera that is also controlled gyroscopically by the gyroscope that he has attached to the virtual reality goggles. You really have to see the video to understand what's going on here. But the cool thing is that you put these goggles on, and as you turn your head, the camera on the aircraft responds to your head movements, and apparently it makes it pretty much just like flying inside the radio controlled airplane. And this guy in the video that Mike sent this morning was buzzing the field and flying in among the trees and everything else. It was very, very cool. I like that one. Hey, but and Mike, that page led me to another one that was more scientific. I sent it to you this morning, and I put both of these up on my my video page that you can get to from the gadgeteer.us website. And this one was magnets and superconductivity. They have this chunk of superconductive material, and they have an ordinary little disc magnet. And ordinarily, you put the magnet up on top of the material, and it just sits there. But then they pour, I don't know, I guess something they pour on it that generates a lot of really cool scientific-looking fog and smoke, and it cools the superconducting material down to the point, apparently, where it starts to superconduct. And just sitting there, then they take the magnet, and the thing just floats in the air above this little cube. Very cool video. I recommend it. It'll be on the website later in the morning. KL7R M0HPR.
Well, cool, Bill. Well, that brought up that brought up two or three ideas. before you give up on the idea of shutting off the entire power to your whole apartment, you should hitch up a battery to your 17-meter rig, and being prepared to reset all the clocks in your house. You should kill the power to your house and find out if it's you, and just kill all the power to your house and throw it on one breaker at a time. And if it goes away when you shut off the power to your house, that's a hopeful sign, and then you can start throwing on breakers till you find out which section it's on, and then. And then you're way ahead. I found a really horrible SCR controlled dimmer light that I asked my wife if I could throw away, and she said absolutely not. So I asked if I could make it work better, and I clipped all of the SCR circuitry out of it. It was horrible. And Christmas lights, I've seen them this time of year. Christmas lights are bad. Speaking of the superconducting thing, I was out looking for information on how to build a tricorder, like Spock has. only it's not a Spock tricorder. It's the guy that Ramsey Electronics sells this thing. It shows electric field, and then it shows magnetic field, and then it shows RF field. So my wife asked me to build her one for Christmas. So I'm looking at these Hall effect devices, trying to figure out to detect magnetic field. I decided I wasn't going to use a Hall effect device, but I was going to use a regular compass as a magnetic field detector, and as an electric field detector, electrostatic field detector, I was going to use an FET and an LED and a 9-volt battery. So anyway, Hall effect devices. I saw this thing where this guy had an array of Hall effect devices and electromagnets, and he was using, and then he put a piece of metal over these electromagnets, and the metal would drop closer to the magnets, and the magnets would basically self-adjust with the magnetic field affecting the Hall effect devices, and that causing feedback to give more current to the coils to float your plate. Anyway, it was another way to do a more complicated way of doing suspended whatever that is, floating in the air sort of stuff. M0HBR, KL7R.
Yes, of course, Mike, but you need the dilithium crystals, and I think you need some links to the warp drive there, too, and then it'll work just fine. That there was a schematic on this in 73 magazine shortly before it went under. Well, you lost me there on the Hall effect. I remember it vaguely, but again, this apparently is not a good morning for me to be thinking deep electronic thoughts here. We've just been joined by another very occasional solder smoke participant. 6-year-old Maria Patricia has arrived and is sitting here with me, watching the blue bar jump up and down on the echoing screen. See, I don't think she's going to say anything, but she's going to just sit quietly here and listen. Let's see. I think that brings us to time for our next segment. God, I got to get the gong back. This lamp is just pathetic. It's time for Solder Smoke Mailbag, and we got a couple of we had a couple submissions come in of people who followed up on my request for Google Earth photos of their houses and antennas, and a couple came in. Thank you very much for folks who sent those in, and I might just very anonymously, without any reference to locations or call signs or names, just put them up on the web page so people can see what is possible through Google Earth. That was fun. And then we got another very nice email from Andrew G4CWX, and he told us that well, it's a real DX experience that Andrew had with Solder Smoke. He recently had to take a very long trip, and that involved obviously quite a bit of time in airplanes. I'll tell you about it in a second. But to help him along his way, he decided to put all 40 episodes of Solder Smoke onto his MP3 player. Let's see. He must have. I guess the drives are getting more and more capable, but he got all 40 of them on the MP3 player, and then carried them with him on a trip that went from the UK to Amsterdam, to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, Auckland, New Zealand, Wellington, New Zealand, and then back to the United Kingdom. So that might be a DX record for Solder Smoke to be actually carried around the world like that. But well, we hope you enjoyed it, and we hope it made the trip a little bit easier there, Andrew. I mentioned earlier the Brian KG4ENB's struggle with weird sounding digital signals, but Brian also points out that he too has been blowing up parts. He says his wife describes, that's how his wife describes his homebrewing activities, blowing up parts. And so keep at it, Brian. You need to blow up some more. We're all doing our bit. And it helps also if you burn your fingers every once in a while, too. It's the mark of a real home brewer, by the way, is if you have sort of permanently tattoo burned into your thumb the front face of an MRF 475 transistor or something like that, preferably with the numbers also visible. It's a mark of distinction. this is a good one, Mike. Jorge Luis, KI4SGU, sends us an email, and he has declared that you and I are, quote, the Mythbusters of ham radio. And my question is, which one of us is Adam, and which one of us is Jamie? KL7R, M0HBR.
Well, it's clear I'm the guy with the whiskers, but I'm not sure you're the other guy.
Yeah, comparisons probably don't really fit here, but it was kind of an interesting analogy. So thanks to Jorge Luis for that one.
That's great stuff. I'm going to have to ruminate on that one this evening. Another pleasant solder smoke there, Bill. Do you have any more mailbag, or If not, I'll just say 73 to you and Maria. And hi, Maria. It's been a while since I said hello. I'm in Alaska, and we have lots of snow up here. Over.
Go ahead.
Hello.
There we go. Maria modulating. All right. Yeah, the timing's perfect. Maria's going to be asking for breakfast here in a minute. And the mailbag is empty. We've got through our list. I think maybe next time we'll talk about a minimalist radio. Rick Campbell sent a nice message that I think it was on the EMRFD list about minimalist radio. And then there was a message that went around that Jeff Dam relayed to you about the history of the NE602s. Very interesting. Yeah, we could talk about that maybe next time. And I'm trying to post that message up on my website. So yeah, Mike, let's wrap it up here for Soda Smoke 42. It's been great. Good luck with the projects, and hopefully by next week my thought processes will be improved, and I'll be able to discuss the feedback network that I thought I understood, but now I'm having my doubts. but great. Well, thanks to you and 73 to you and the whole Solder Smoke gang. And until next time, 73 from London, KL7R, M0HBR.
All right, Bill. That one network happens to be parallel, and the ones I saw before were all series. So maybe that adds into the thinking there. Best to you and your family there, Bill. KL7R clear.
Hey, good luck with the snow, 73.